The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Everybody, Bill Buckmaster, along with my friend Ray Allen. Big smile on Ray's face on the other side of the glass there, engineering and producing our program. Together we welcome you to the Buckmaster Show. And it is the midweek edition, first day of August 2018. I'm always glad to see July. For whatever reason, in the rearview mirror, August feels always a lot better to me. I don't know why. We're coming to you live from AM 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice. Of course, we have our worldwide live listening. Anywhere in the world, you can hear this program at buckmastershow.com and kvoi.com. All of our podcasts and the archive that goes back 7 years, at least 7.5 years, all available for you 24/7 at buckmastershow.com. Our live line number is 790-2040. If you'd like to join in during the hour, give us a call. Joining us now on the live line, Steve Herman, Voice of America's White House bureau chief. The veteran journalist spent more than a quarter of a century in Asia, including years of reporting from Tokyo and subsequently as a Voice of America correspondent and bureau chief in India, Korea, and Thailand. He has served back in 2016. He was VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent based at the State Department. He's a native of Cincinnati, Ohio. Steve's journalism odyssey began in Las Vegas in the 1970s, working for KORK, the NBC affiliate in the gambling Mecca, where I happened to be the news director and had the good sense to hire the then young Mr. Herman. Here he is, forever young, Steve Herman. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill, and you took a chance on a rookie, and hopefully I didn't disappoint you.
No, you did not disappoint me, and as you know, we used to do some crazy stuff in Las Vegas. As you know, and our listeners know, I love to travel. Kind of got my country count going when I was in Las Vegas. Steve, what were some of the crazy stories that I called in to Las Vegas from my travels?
Well, I remember one in particular from Papua New Guinea, where you reported on a war between natives, where they, as you put it, were exchanging spears, and that was not a friendly exchange.
That probably was one of the most colorful stories that I filed. But you kind of got that sense working with me, and it sure has carried over as you're now very well-traveled. But I was traveling commercial. You've been a frequent flyer on Air Force One. What's that?
Probably get better food in your flight.
What is that like, that experience on Air Force One? Are you pretty much confined to one area, can get up and move around, or what?
Yes, we can get up and move around in our part of the rear cabin, which is for the media. There's 13 journalists that travel with the president. It's a pool, meaning that there are designated videographers, still photographers, wire service reporters, newspaper reporters, and then radio and television correspondents who have to share any information that we get with the other members of the pool who are not on the trip. And actually, the food's not bad. It's the U.S. Air Force that's serving us the foods, although I'm sure among your listeners out there who've been in the Navy, they would argue the Navy has the best food in the military, which from my experience is true. While we can't sort of go up and talk to the president in his area, he has the liberty, and he does, especially this president, comes back and talks to us from time to time, sometimes on the record, sometimes on background, and often off the record. And that also happens with members of his cabinet, the press secretary or a deputy press secretary who may be on the flight. The problem I always have is whenever it's mealtime and I've got the food on my tray there, that's when the president decides to come back and you've got to sort of panic. I've got about 3 seconds to fire up all my equipment to record, because usually in those situations it's called a gaggle, where the president, if he's on the record, it's not usually allowed to be videotaped. So that radio audio that I'm recording becomes the broadcast record for all the media to refer to as a quick transcript as soon as we get on the ground.
And you have to have a pretty loud voice, because you're often the pool reporter when the president is walking from the White House out to the helicopter and all that noise. And you manage to you get your fair share of questions in, don't you?
Yes, both on the South Lawn when the helicopter Marine One is idling, and also with Air Force One on the tarmac, sometimes the president will come over and speak to us, and you have to get his attention, and you have to have a loud voice, but you don't want to sound rude, and there's been a lot of controversy, as you know, lately, especially about these what are called pool sprays in the Oval Office, where a pool is going in, and then at the end of it, there are questions also shouted. And recently there was a problem with a CNN reporter who was reprimanded for her question and banned from a subsequent open press event later in that day. And if you think this is anything new, actually this controversy about asking questions of the president during these so-called pool sprays goes back at least to the Reagan administration.
So this is not particularly new for just the Trump administration and his so-called war on the media.
Right. The faces have changed, both in the Oval Office and among some of the reporters. Obviously, CNN, Jim Acosta is one name for which the president seems to have a particular ire. But I would note that other reporters, including those from Fox News Channel, the favorite of the president, also ask these sort of questions during these pool sprays as well.
We'll get back to some of the kind of the inside stuff with Steve Herman. But first, I want to ask you about a briefing. Just a few minutes ago, I saw your Facebook page post that there was a news briefing with the press secretary, Sarah Sanders, and you managed to get a question in. And she seems to be calling on you a lot more often. Do you get a chance to move up rows as or are you still pretty much in the same position in the room?
I feel fortunate that we have a seat, because that is quite an exclusive presence. And those seats are actually decided by the White House Correspondents Association, not by the White House itself. Hmm. The White House can determine who gets into the area, into the building. You can get an appointment pass, and almost any journalist who has any sort of accreditation, and I would also argue that some of those who have been here for a long time have no connection to any real media, but they've been around and roaming about. There are some sort of seemingly eccentric so-called journalists that have been a tradition at the White House for many decades. So it's not difficult to get a pass to come into the building, but to get one of the seats, your organization has had to have had a significant presence here for some years, and to be regarded as a legitimate news organization. So we're in the fourth row. Usually what happens, the questions at the beginning will go to those first row reporters, those very familiar faces that you see from television, but also the wire services, the Associated Press and Reuters. And Sarah will move around the room. And usually, because of the Voice of America, our audience is outside the United States. We have 45 language services, including English and Learning English. So my questions tend to be more of a geopolitical nature. I'm going to be asking about North Korea or China or Somalia or Russia, Afghanistan, those types of world issues. So I think she knows that perhaps when she's pointing to me that she's going to get a bit of a break from the front row inquisition about the Russia probe. And usually by the time she calls on me, those questions have been asked, not that they're asked three or four times again. And Sarah is pretty good about sticking to message and repeating her answers. So I have been fortunate, and it's a great service for our listeners. But today I actually asked a question about Space Force.
Yes.
The president, as you know, wants to create a sixth branch of the military, the Space Force. And our information that we had is that the Pentagon had missed a deadline to submit a report to Congress today about this, and that the White House had twice apparently rejected drafts of this Pentagon report because the generals over at the Defense Department are not so keen on Space Force. They would rather have a Space Command under the existing structure, similar to what we have like Northern Command.
Is there any truth to the rumor that it would be based in Roswell, New Mexico?
Well, that seems like it'd be an appropriate place, but maybe your congressional representatives there can lobby for Tucson. I think you've got some pretty big airstrips there.
We do. It is time to tell my listeners, Steve, about my favorite bakery, and you know me very well. And do you remember how I loved those brownies at a particular bakery in Las Vegas?
Your specialty, I remember, were the Napoleon desserts at the top of the dunes on the Las Vegas Strip, which unfortunately was literally blown up some years ago.
Yes. Well, Steve Herman knows I love bakery goods, and of course, it's very appropriate. One of our sponsors is Mona's, home of the Danish Kringle, located northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. The owner, Steve, and his lovely wife, Sherry, they put together just these lovely European baked goods. The bread you'll be eating now on your sandwich during the lunch hour came out of the oven just a few hours ago. Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Go to my website, buckmastershow.com, a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. When we come back, White House correspondent, chief correspondent for the Voice of America, Steve Herman, and we'll get to Jim Kelly's question, Jim, right after we take the break.
Get your tickets now for Arizona Wildcats football. Kevin Sumlin leads the program into a new era, and we want you to be part of it. Season tickets start at the new low price of $70 for all seven home games. Flex packs, group tickets, and single game tickets are also on sale. The new era of Arizona football starts September 1st when the Wildcats take on BYU at Arizona Stadium. Get your tickets today at arizonawildcats.com/FB or call 621-CATS.
In case you haven't heard, a recent state performance audit says the Regional Transportation Authority is meeting performance and budget expectations on voter-approved RTA plan delivery. Now in its 12th year of plan implementation, the RTA is committed to delivering the remaining projects with the community's support to improve our regional transportation system. Working together for a better future, visit rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. One of my passions is travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. When I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport with six airlines flying nonstop to 19 destinations and easy one-stop connections I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient, with competitive airfares, and the best part is there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Check out flytucson.com, travel smart, and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com.
Hi, it's Suzanne Miller from your Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona, here to remind you to start with trust. and look for the BBB accredited seal when searching for a product or service. Did you know you can request a quote directly from any of our accredited businesses? With over 3,000 accredited businesses in Southern Arizona, you will find a business you can trust. Whether you need a product or service from one company or an entire industry, go to tucson.bbb.org and start your search today.
As a small business owner, I know the importance of a certified public accountant you can trust. That's why I recommend my CPA, Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates, proud sponsors of the Buckmaster Show. Located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com or follow the live link on buckmastershow.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. Join us Thursday during the noon hour for a newsmaker interview with Dr. Gabriel Trujillo. Dr. Trujillo is superintendent of the Tucson Unified School District. Buckmaster, noon to 1 on Tucson's Voice, AM 1030 KVOI. Anywhere in the world, live listening, podcasts, and show archive at buckmastershow.com. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, this portion presented by our friends over in Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. We send so many of our listeners over there, and they all come back with the same thing, saying the same thing. Bill, I wish I had been over there sooner. I didn't even realize it's just a three-hour drive from Tucson. So many recreation opportunities, including the world-famous Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument, is just north of historic Silver City. And you know that elevation's about mile high, anywhere from 5,500 to 7,500 feet. That means it's going to be cooler over there, and the Gila has really greened up from all these summer rains. Go to southwestnewmexico.org for more information. Steve Herman is the chief White House correspondent for the Voice of America, and Jim Kelly, who is a good friend of this program, is on the live line, and he is also a big fan of Mr. Herman. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, yes, Steve, I am a huge fan of yours on Voice of America. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I firmly believe you're going to be the reporter of record for this presidency. My question is, when you do get the questions from the president, is it just kind of a throwaway answer that he's giving, or is he kind of look you in the eye and know exactly what you're asking him?
Jim, I think that depends. If it's something that's really been on the president's mind, then he tends to be a bit more effusive about it. Other times, he'll just want to brush it off and give some sort of a curt answer. But the interesting thing is that he does answer the questions, these encounters, these so-called pool sprays in the Oval Office or the walks on the South Lawn or on the airport tarmac. A lot of previous presidents did not answer questions, but President Trump does answer them routinely. He's been criticized quite a bit for not having formal news conferences where he's just speaking to the White House press for a period of time and taking a number of questions, which was customary in previous administrations. This president prefers to do them in the when he has a visitor, such as another president or prime minister, and then it's in the so-called 2+2 format, where there's only two questions usually from each side, but President Trump has been known to extend that a little bit. So I hope that answers your question.
Also, Steve, I wanted to talk a little bit about President Trump's criticism of the Russia investigation. Apparently, that criticism has reached new heights with the president calling on his attorney general to end the investigation right now. What's your reaction?
Yes, that's the main story I've been working on today. I wish I could devote my day to Space Force, but the president has been tweeting quite a bit about this earlier in the day. And this was really his most forceful call yet to end this federal criminal investigation. And this was also the subject of some back and forth during the press briefing today, because, as you may know from listening to the newscasts on this station, that the president said that he wanted an end to this right now. And that and seemed to be ordering Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who, of course, had removed himself from oversight of the probe, to do something. Well, the White House, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, saying that this was not an order. This was an opinion of the president, so that there's been no transmittal of anything to the Justice Department ordering Mueller to be fired, which, because Jeff Sessions has recused himself, would have to be done, presumably, by the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. So despite all the fury on Twitter today, essentially nothing has changed. But I did talk to a national security lawyer and asked him about the possible legal ramifications of those tweets, and that'll be in my story coming out later today. And basically, a number of attorneys are saying this certainly doesn't help the president, and I think even a lot of the president's ardent supporters here in the White House would like to see him stop tweeting about all this. But essentially, it could come down to a political decision rather than a legal decision on whether this could possibly lead to impeachment charges in the future against the president.
Well, this president has said that the media, people that cover the news, are enemies of the people, yet he relies so much on the media. He's a huge consumer, as everybody knows, of media.
Yes, absolutely. I think President Trump, going back to his early days as a real estate figure in New York City, has had a love-hate relationship with the media. I think he was able to mold the media more in the way he liked it in New York City with the local newspapers, especially the tabloids, and sort of expected that when he became president that would be the relationship he would be able to have with the White House press. Of course, it's a completely different ball game here. And I think it should be pointed out that it comes with the job. If you're going to be president of the United States, you're going to have to answer a lot of questions from reporters, many of them that you do not like. That's been the case with every single president. I don't think any of the presidents we've had have been enamored with reporters. But using this phrase, enemies of the people, I did a story about this early last year when it first came up, and noted that this type of language is seen by historians, not only journalists, having some real ominous overtones, because it's been used in when you've been called an enemy of the people in places like the Soviet Union. Well, that got you sent off to the gulag at yeah. very best. So there is a lot of concern and a bit of alarm. Again, there was a rally last night in Tampa, Florida, where we had people yelling at Jim Acosta, cursing him, extending a middle finger, that sort of thing. And there's a lot of concern that this could go beyond theatrics. And all it takes, as you know, Bill, one unstable person to think that they've been emboldened and lash out in a violent way. So hopefully that will not happen. But I think there's not a journalist here who would wish that the president would refrain from using that type of language.
Where can our listeners find out more about Voice of America and hear and follow your reports?
VOANews.com would be the easiest way. And I should say that your listeners are not our intended audience, because we are part of the federal government, and we are mandated to broadcast in a number of different languages, 44, 45 in total right now, to the rest of the world. So the way that I write stories, it's not intended for an American audience. And until a few years ago, under the Smith-Mundt Act, which was passed after World War II, it was actually prohibited for us to disseminate our content domestically. However, with the Internet, that's obviously a little bit of a an archaic a position. But we do not promote our content in the United States, but we cannot prohibit anybody from going to the website and looking at it. I'm quite active on Twitter as well, and I know that a significant percentage of my Twitter followers are in the United States, but our intended audience is overseas.
All right, Steve Herman, we will let you get to work and start filing your reports. And, of course, it's not just radio. You do TV as well, right?
That is correct.
All right, Steve, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll be in touch. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, Steve Herman, my friend, the White House chief correspondent for The Voice of America. We'll be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Next time you book a flight, type in TUS. Travel smart and fly Tucson. It's the way to go.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com. Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. One of our great sponsors is Green Things. Green Things is now the home to Zocalo. For years, Zocalo was headquartered over there at Country Club and Broadway, near the intersection there. And they have all that wonderful merchandise from Mexico and Latin America. Well, now Zocalo's new home is Green Things. They're on the 13-acre Green Things site. So not only can you do all of your gardening and your nursery needs at Green Things, but you can get some great stuff for your home, for your interior decorating as well, with the Zocalo merchandise. Check out Green Things for all of your gardening needs. They're on the web at greenthingsaz.com. One of Tucson's most famous murder investigations involved a young man that Life magazine dubbed the Pied Piper of Tucson. They dubbed him so because of his ability to get teens to follow him and to keep his secrets. His real name was Charles Schmid, who killed three teenage girls between 1964 and 1965. Tucson resident Lisa Espich, her father, Richard Bruns, was a close friend of Schmid, and he actually was the one who blew the whistle, resulting in Schmid's arrest and conviction. During the time of the trials between 1966 and 1965, Lisa's father wrote his firsthand account of what happened. After his writing was finished, he packed the manuscript away like a time capsule. Now, 50 years later, the manuscript has been discovered by Lisa and her sisters, allowing their father to finally share his side of the story. And the book is now titled, I, a Squealer. Lisa Espich joins me now in studio. Lisa, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Bill. I really appreciate it.
When did you first hear the name Charles Schmid?
When I was a child, probably around 10 or 11, I knew the name Charles Schmid because there was a book in my home that was called Tucson Murders. And I stumbled across it on our bookshelf, and I remember looking through it, and it was really, I wasn't reading it at that time, but I was looking at the pictures, and there was a photo of my father, and there were photos of Charles Schmid, who was quite an evil-looking person in this book. And so at that time, I knew who Charles Schmid was, and I knew that my father had some involvement, but it wasn't anything that my parents talked to us about. And because I didn't really read the book, I was just looking at pictures, I knew there was an involvement. I didn't really know what the specifics were.
When I came out to the University of Arizona in 1965 as a young 17-year-old from Chicago, I remember if there was like one story that I remember during my 4 years here in Tucson, one local story that is ingrained and on my brain, it's the story about the Pied Piper of Tucson. This was a huge national story that Life magazine picked up, right, about this guy. He would like cruise Speedway, and he would like pick up kids and stuff, and it really a weird kind of thing. And how did your father know him?
My father met him when he was 15 years old. My father was 13 and Charles Schmid was 18. So he was 5 years older than my father. But Charles Schmid hung around with a lot of younger teenagers. And my father would see him at different parties and at the Tucson High School. Charles Schmid would come in his car and hang out at lunchtime. And so my father met him that way. But he really got to know Charles Schmid a little bit later when he was at a thrifty drugstore speaking with a mutual friend who worked at that thrifty, and Charles Schmid came in and started the conversation with them and chimed in. And then when my father was walking home from Thrifty, Charles Schmid pulled up in his car and asked my dad if he wanted a ride home. And my dad accepted the ride. And really from that time on, they really got to know each other and spent a lot of time together and became really good friends.
Well, a lot of people knew of Schmid, and I just got a Facebook post I'll share with you, Lisa, and our friends. Rich writes, "I haven't heard the name Charles Schmid since I was a teenager working at Bob's Big Boy." Anybody that was around at that time, I remember Bob's.
Yeah.
That was over at Broadway and Tucson Boulevard back in 1965. Rich goes on to say, "Schmid was a regular customer who sat at the counter drinking coffee for hours. He freaked out all the waitresses there. He scared them, and we found out later why." I mean, this guy was known pretty much all over town.
Everyone seemed to know who he was, and he had a huge following of friends. And I know he's saying that he freaked out the waitresses, but the thing about Charles Schmid is he had a very charismatic way.
He could charm the waitresses, right?
And parents really liked him. And, you know, people really gravitated toward him. And so there was definitely something about him that while he did kind of grow into a strange person as this was all starting to happen, he also was, you know, a good-looking, charismatic guy that people really liked to be around.
So your dad took this initial ride with him. So what happened next?
Well, they became good friends, like I said. They spent a lot of time together. My father at that point had dropped out of high school, and Charles Schmid had also dropped out of high school in his senior year. So neither of them was working. They really had a lot of time on their hands, and so they hung out almost daily, just talking and spending a lot of time together. Eventually, Charles Schmid confided in my father that he had killed Aline Rowe, a young teenage girl. That was May of 1964, and he told my father about that. My father at the time, everyone knew that Aline was missing, and the police had already questioned all of the kids, including Charles Schmid, and it was assumed at that time she was a runaway. So my father at the time was not sure if he believed what Charles Schmid was saying, because he was a real storyteller and was always telling far-fetched stories. And so my father wasn't sure at that time if he was just, you know, telling a tale.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did he know it was, eventually, how did he know this was the real deal?
Well, eventually, the next year, a year later, is when he killed the next two victims, which was Charles Schmid's girlfriend and the girlfriend's younger sister. And when they came up missing, my father was speculative of Charles Schmid being the murderer, because Charles Schmid had said that he wanted to murder her because they were having a lot of problems. Oh. And when they came up missing, my father did believe he could have killed the girls, but again, didn't have any evidence. And then Charles Schmid did confide in my father about that. My father at the time didn't know what to do with that information. He had no specifics to go to the police. The police had already questioned Charles Schmid about this. They had no proof against Charles Schmid. And so he really kept it to himself, not knowing what to do with it, and started growing afraid of what Charles Schmid was capable of doing. He also had reason to believe that Charles Schmid had sights on the girl that he was in love with, and my father started watching over that girl's house. She lived right down the street from him, because he had seen Charles Schmid hanging around her house late at night, and there was no reason for him to be doing that. And so he started worrying that she was going to be the next victim. So my father took it upon himself to be the one to protect her and keep Charles Schmid away from her. Of course, that caused a lot of problems for my father, because the family didn't know why he was doing that and assumed that he was obsessed with their daughter, and eventually got a restraining order against my father.
So your grandparents, how did they feel about all this?
Well, they didn't
Your dad's parents.
Yeah, so they didn't know anything about this until the restraining order came up, till they took him to court to get a restraining order. And he didn't confide in his parents what Charles Schmid had told him. So he was still keeping this all to himself. And so they probably themselves thought their son was, you know, obsessed with this girl. And the courts told my father that he had to go to Columbus, Ohio to be with his grandmother to separate him from this girl. Mm. Right before this happened, an important part of the story happened, though, where the mafia, so Joe Bonanno, who was here with his family, Joe Bonanno's son and Joseph Battaglia, which was another person in the mafia, had taken my father and Charles Schmid to an apartment complex shortly before my dad was sent to Columbus, Ohio, and they were questioning Charles Schmid and my father about the disappearance of Gretchen and Wendy Fritz.
They wanted to kind of get to the bottom of it themselves as citizens of the community, or what? I mean,
so Joe Bonanno, his heart surgeon, was Gretchen Fritz's father.
Oh.
And so clearly there was a connection that the heart surgeon had this involvement with Joe Bonanno, and so he was going to help the father try and find the daughters. But after that meeting, my dad became very paranoid about what was going to happen, because now the mafia was involved and he felt like he was getting way deep in this.
What year was this now?
So that would have been in 1965.
Okay, so the first murder was
1964, May 1964. Okay. The girls were murdered in August of 1965. And so shortly after that, probably around September, is when the mafia had taken Charles Schmid and my father to an apartment complex to question them.
How were the girls murdered? All same way, or?
So it's believed that they were strangled, because once they did find the bodies and the forensics were done, there was no evidence other than probably a strangling.
And the bodies were found in the desert?
Yeah, they were just laying out in the desert. That night that the mafia had taken them,
taken them for their questioning.
Yes. Charles Schmid confided in my father after that he had just left the girls laying in the desert. My father saw that as his opportunity to find out if this really happened, and said, well, if they're just laying out in the desert, we need to go bury them. Mm-hmm. And kind of calling his bluff. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, he did take him out to the bodies, which was out on Pontotoc Road.
In the foothills.
Correct.
Well, we're going to pick up the story after the break, because it is a fascinating story. Lisa Espich is with us, and her dad, Richard Bruns, told and has told his inside story in a manuscript that's now a book. The book is titled I, a Squealer. We're going to pick up on all of this with Lisa right after the break. The Regional Transportation Authority funds projects to help make our transportation system safe, reliable, and efficient. Improved regional mobility is important for economic vitality for businesses and families. The RTA continues to finance construction work for 6 new roadway projects scheduled in 2018. For more information on RTA projects, visit rtamobility.com. The RTA is delivering its promise to you. If you're searching for that special one-of-a-kind item, may I suggest Adobe House Antiques. It has a vast collection and variety of antiques, lighting, and fine art. In addition to the interior space, a large outdoor location offers an extensive collection of vintage patio furniture, exterior lighting, and ironwork. Come see Penny at 2700 North Campbell, 325-9439, or on the web at adobehouseantiques.com.
Southern Arizona is home to one of the world's most trusted sources of information on medicines. The Credible Meds website is visited each day by over 2,000 people from more than 60 countries. You too can learn how to personalize your medications and take control of your health care. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and join Bill Buckmaster each month as he and Dr. Ray Woosley, founder of Credible Meds, give you practical tips on how to get the most from your medications.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local independent nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from the Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on Celebrity Cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
Welcome back. We're talking with Lisa Espich. It's a fascinating story about her father, Richard Bruns, who was a close friend of Charles Schmid. Schmid was known as the Pied Piper of Tucson. He killed three teenage girls between 1964 and 65. Life magazine had a huge article about him after the arrest and during the trial. And Lisa, your dad really became this close friend and was the one who blew the whistle resulting in Schmid's arrest and conviction. So as we pick up the story, your dad and Schmid actually go to the desert to see where Schmid had apparently left two of the three victims.
Correct. The plan was to bury the bodies. And again, my father, part of that was just he wanted to see if these bodies really existed. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they did. He writes about how difficult that was because at that time they had already been out there for about a month in the desert heat. So you can imagine how horrific that was. And once he was out there with Charles Schmid and the bodies, he became extremely frightened that Charles Schmid may even kill him now that he has him out in the desert. My dad knows all of this. So my dad did what he could to, you know, show him he was trying to help bury these bodies. And then after that, he really became, you know, obsessed with protecting this girl. And that's when the family got the restraining order. The court sent my father to Columbus, Ohio. And once my father was in Columbus, it only took a matter of days, and he just couldn't take not knowing if that girl was safe. And that's when he finally called the Tucson police and told them what had happened.
And that girl being his girlfriend.
She was his girlfriend initially.
And he was very worried Schmid was going to come after her.
Yes.
Okay, so he goes then, and did he call the Tucson police? When was that then?
So that was in November of 1965.
Okay, and the police then take the call, and then do they bring him immediately back
Correct.
From Columbus?
The next day, they brought him back from Columbus, Ohio to Tucson to have him take them out to the bodies, which he does. And as soon as they have the bodies recovered, that's when they go in and arrest Charles Schmid. They were also able to get, one thing we didn't mention is the first girl who was killed,
right.
Charles Schmid got two other teenagers to do that killing with him.
Oh, really?
And my father knew of that story.
That was in 1964.
That was the 1964.
That was the first victim, and there were two accomplices then.
Correct. A girl and a teenage boy that helped with that.
Were they then arrested?
Yes. And so my father did tell the police of that story. They did arrest those two, who were actually both out of town, mm-hmm. and they had to go out of town and bring them back. But they both admitted to their part of that killing. And so once they had that, they were able to go right in and arrest Charles Schmid.
What did Schmid say when he was arrested about your dad?
Well,
he must
never
have been really upset, right?
He was. He never admitted to the police of any of the killings. And he claimed that it was my father who actually killed the two teenage girls and was trying to pin it on him.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And my father writes, I think one of the most intense parts of my father's book is he writes of having to go down and face Charles Schmid at the police headquarters and go into the room. And that's when Charles Schmid knows that it was my father. And it was very intense and difficult for my father to do that.
Lori called. She has a quick question
yes.
for you, Lisa. Go ahead, Lori.
So when your father went out to the desert and found the bodies along with Schmidt, what was the condition of the bodies? Were they fully intact? Had animals been eating on them?
So they were still somewhat intact, but they had, my father writes of, you know, that obviously the smell that he could never get out of his head, and they definitely were already, you know, breaking down. And so that was...
But there was enough forensic evidence to identify
yes.
to the two victims.
Yes. And actually, by the time the police were taken out there, it would have been about 3 months that they had been passed away. And so they pretty much were skeletal remains by then when the police got to
so
them.
So the trial begins when?
So the trials would have started right in the new year of 1966. In the month of March, I believe, is when the trial, it wasn't a very long trial. I think it all happened in March. And the first trial was actually for Aline Rowe.
The first victim?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, I'm sorry, I have that wrong. It was the sisters. And so he did get a death sentence for the killing of the sisters.
Oh, okay.
And then shortly after was the second trial, which was for Aline Rowe.
Was there a change in venue? Was that a Tucson trial or was that moved out of town?
They both were in Tucson.
They were both in town. That's,
yes.
That is a little surprising to me with all that publicity with Life magazine that there was not a change in venue. But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that Life picked up on it when this a huge story when the trial began. So Schmid was sentenced to life or death?
Death for the girls and then a life sentence for Aline Rowe. But then in 1971, Arizona abolished the death penalty. They found it unconstitutional. Hmm. And so his death sentence was converted to a life sentence. And once that happened, he was actually taken into another area of the prison where he was able to go off-site and work off-site. And he did actually end up escaping prison.
Wow.
Yeah, he was caught like 3 days later. But he and another triple murderer, Raymond Hudgens, had escaped from prison. And they took several hostages, and then they left the hostages in Tempe, Arizona, and separated. Charles Schmid was discovered here at a Tucson rail yard, mm-hmm. and but he was discovered with a photo of my mom and my sisters, and so it was believed that he might be coming after my father and us, and so we were put under police protection at that
time. What happened to Schmid?
He was murdered in prison by fellow inmates. He was stabbed between 20 and 40 times.
Whoa.
Yeah.
When was that then?
So that was 1975.
Okay. So how does this change? How has this affected your family and your dad?
As far as the book coming out?
Yeah, everything, the book and you know, there's a sense of relief getting the story out because Was your dad kind of shunned after all of this?
Very much so. So for the first at least 1 to 2 decades, he had a very difficult time just moving past this. Mm-hmm. He had a very hard time initially finding work. A lot of people believed that he was more involved than he was, and so that was held over his head. And my mother, you know, has shared that they were just really shunned. Yeah. And so it was very difficult for them initially. Now having the book come out and having his side of the story come out, it's just for him to be able to have his side shared, because no one ever asked him his side of the story. And, you know, one of the ways that I encouraged him to put this out there is, you know, 50 years later, things were still popping up with these stories. And in fact, Discovery Channel had done a Crime to Remember series. They did a whole thing on the Pied Piper. Mm-hmm. And they portrayed my father in such an over-the-top way, which and it really, you know, frustrated him. And I reminded him that, you know, this story is not dying out. People still talk about this 50 years later, but you have your side of the story to share so people understand how you got involved.
And the manuscript was just up in the attic, or where was it?
Yeah, it was just boxed away with old photos and things. My father had believed, you know, it was gone by then. He was surprised that we had even found it when I told him that we had discovered it.
I'm so glad you and your sister got involved with this. This is really a great story.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean that you two became very proactive, and you wanted your dad's story out there because your dad did the right thing.
Yeah, and this is part of his history, so I want his side to be heard.
Okay, where can people get the book, which is titled I, a Squealer?
Well, it's available anywhere books are sold, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I know the Bookmans here in town all have it, as well as all of the independent bookstores here in town. But anywhere online that you can get books. And the website is iasqueeler.com.
Is it doing well?
It is doing well, okay. Especially in the Tucson area.
Yeah,
people are very, very excited to see this.
Lisa Espich, thank you very much, Lisa.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, coming up this afternoon, Mic Check with Mike Shaw and Ray Allen, Wake Up Tucson 6 to 9, and then me, Bill Buckmaster. Tomorrow we've got our every other month visit with the school superintendent, Dr. Gabriel Trujillo. We'll get an update as school starts now for TUSD. It's back to school for lots of the kids. On behalf of Ray Allen, Lisa Espich, thank you, Lisa, again for being with us. I'm Bill Buckmaster. Have a great afternoon and evening.